Have you ever noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things that they run on? And that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass just whatever legislation that they want. They are bound by the Overton window. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians typically only act within a narrow window of policy options. And on the Overton Window podcast, we talk to people who work to shift the Overton window and change what is politically possible. I'm Mike Van Beek, and joining me today is Justin Calais, who is chief economist with the Archbridge Institute and co-editor of Profectus magazine. He previously served as an assistant professor of economics and finance at the University of Louisiana Lafayette. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Mike. Excited for the conversation.
So you recently released a report about social mobility with the Archbridge Institute. What is social mobility?
So social mobility, I think if you ask, 100 people, you're going to get 100 different answers. The way that we define it here at Archbridge, and I think kind of encapsulates what people really mean when they talk about social mobility, is the extent to which individuals and families can improve their relative economic or social standing over time, whether that's through work, entrepreneurship, human capital formation. It's basically the idea that essentially where you're born or the situation you're born in should not be determinant of how your life ends up, that you have this ability to move up and down relative to the rest of society, and it's not determined by just where you happen to be born.
And so what are some of the report addresses barriers to social mobility? So what are some of those barriers, and how are they connected to different government policies?
Yeah, definitely. So in the report, we look at four different pillars, because the idea is that we want to get an entire life cycle, understanding that people's opportunities and the ways that they can flourish is not just determined at any one moment in time, but through their entire life cycle. So these pillars try to take into account all the different stages in life in which one might have the opportunities or barriers to achieving opportunity or mobility. So the first barrier that we look at is the environment for entrepreneurship and economic growth. It comes from the general idea that entrepreneurship and economic growth are positive sum games, and that they lead to positive outcomes for not just the entrepreneur, but as well as other people in society. So the idea that, if we encourage entrepreneurship and we have pro-growth policies, we're going to have policies that allow for more opportunities. And this is where some of the policies kind of directly related here would look at occupational licensing or business regulation, while also looking at tax regulation and tax measurements, as well as housing regulations and housing affordability, and finally, business dynamism. So how dynamic of an environment a particular state is in. The second that we look at is institutions and rule of law, realizing that the legal institutions matter a lot to people's opportunities. Here we consider factors related to the judicial system, as well as kind of measures at which states can kind of proactively harm its citizens. So we call that predatory state action. So these are things like fines and fees that governments use as other essentially non-tax revenue that they can take into place. We look at corruption, civil asset forfeiture. In the legal system, we look at, how easily can someone actually access justice? Like, how well does equal justice under the law actually really hold up across each of these states? As well as how high quality the state liability system is, realizing that much like business regulations and taxes, a state's state liability systems is going to be a huge determining factor on how easily businesses can actually engage in business activities in that state.
Sure.
The third pillar we look at are education and skills development. Again, taking that kind of whole life cycle approach. So look at things starting from basically when someone's an infant, looking at childcare regulations, as well as education quality, school choice, and other education freedom measures, as well as how well community colleges perform, and as well as universities and more traditional four-year degree systems work. But we also realize there that all education doesn't just happen in the classroom. Education also happens inside of the home. There's a huge literature that talks about the importance of family stability and family engagement, parental engagement particularly. So look at measures about how stable families are. So how many, you know, what is the percentage of households that are to that have, you know, single parents? What percentage of births were to unmarried women in the last year, as well as how engaged parents are with their children's lives in terms of sharing meals, attending their children's activities, and reading to their children. Because we find that all of these measures actually have a really large effect on current literacy rates, as well as later lifetime outcomes as well. And then finally, we get to social capital, which looks at how well a community, the way I look at it, at least, is how social capital is basically fills in the gaps of where government kind of one size fits all actions. It kind of fills in the gaps where these one size fits all policies don't necessarily fit perfectly into anyone's particular circumstances. So it kind of takes the community or individual level approach here. This is how, you know, much people interact with their neighbors, how what percentage of people belong to a group, who attends events on community, community connectedness, like how diverse is that kind of connection in terms of income levels, or high income people friends with low income people and vice versa. And also charity, which kind of very directly gets at a lot of that kind of individual help that people, you know, need in certain circumstances. So that looks at charity regulations. So how easy is it to start a charity in the first place, and how easy is it to operate one, as well as, you know, just volunteer measures in terms of what percentage of people make donations and how many nonprofit organizations or religious congregations there are in a state, and the percentage of people that volunteered their time with a group in the last year. And over those four pillars, we kind of get a pretty accurate picture, I believe, of each state's, you know, pros and cons and kind of their strengths and weaknesses on how it relates to social mobility, realizing that no state does it perfectly, but also that no state fails on every single category either.
Yeah. It strikes me that the first two pillars on rule of law and entrepreneurship and business regulation, those seem to be well covered in the literature, especially in economics, especially in political science kind of research and academic work. But the last two on education and social capital, talking about the strengths of communities and strengths of families and some of the, you know, like developing soft skills and things like that, that doesn't seem like issues that economists typically look at when they're assessing, you know, how to create economic growth. Is that true? I mean, is one of the points of your report to kind of add in those other factors that maybe the research in the literature hasn't been accounting for as much?
Yeah, I think it's fair to some extent. I do think that there are a lot of high quality scholars who are looking into this and have done a lot of great work on this. For example, I'll mention a senior fellow for the Archbridge Institute, a Nobel Prize winner, James Heckman, who's done a lot of work on kind of education formation and the importance of family and skills development in achieving, you know, how its role plays in both economic growth as well as mobility. And then with social capital, I think you see a lot of work from Raj Chetty and his team at Opportunity Insights. They kind of look at, as well as Scott Winship at AEI, who look at, you know, the importance of social capital in this. But I definitely agree that, you know, we have a lot of focus on the entrepreneurship and economic growth side. I think that's great, right? I do think that and I don't think we're perfect at it anywhere across the country. So I do think there's obviously more room for improvement in a lot of those areas. But I think that was one of the things when looking at this report, we wanted to kind of take a wider scope and look at all of the different factors that other people have shown to matter for mobility and opportunity, because we didn't want this to just become a report of variables that we liked, but variables that, you know, we found through academic work and high quality policy work that tends to matter for opportunities and mobility.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So I've done some of these kinds of projects before, benchmarking different, whether it's, you know, different factors or different indices across states. And when you do that, I know you have to make 1,000 small decisions about what to include and what not to include and what data is relevant enough and which isn't and all these kinds of things. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about that experience of designing this index. And, you know, did you have a particular strategy or did you have particular strategies that were helpful in making some of those kinds of decisions?
Yeah, I would say to kind of take a small step back at first, at least when we were looking at kind of what we thought mattered for mobility. It took a lot of time to look into the different literatures across different, you know, different types of economic work going on throughout the country and throughout the world on what matters for mobility. And that gave us a good standpoint in terms of those four pillars that I mentioned earlier. It kind of gives us a good benchmark, at least, of like, all right, here's the general categories that matter for mobility most concretely. And then from there, it was, well, what's actually measurable, right? Sure, there are things that, you know, you hope you can, you know, you're like, oh, it'd be perfect if we had a measurement on X.
Yeah, what matters is not always measured. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that was where, you know, that was definitely where a lot of the work went into of trying to find those specific measures. I think that was one of the, on my end, at least one of the bright sides of, I believe, this report, is that given that we used a lot of work that other people have done, that finding those variables made it a little bit easier in terms to make those connections, because it was oftentimes similar variables that people looked at themselves. So, for example, in terms of social capital, this is something that we looked at Raj Chetty's work, or we looked at Scott Winship's work. And those two great scholars have a lot of great insights and have done a lot of heavy lifting in terms of finding these variables, or in many cases, creating those variables that get us those measures. So that definitely helped us in terms of being able to make a more concrete decision of, okay, well, we know that this measure matters. In terms of kind of all across, it was, you know, you kind of had to cast a wide net in terms of mm-hmm. spend a lot of time looking at all these different data sets, realizing like, so this is close to getting what we want, but it's not exactly perfect. So in terms of college, right? So we could just look at, you know, USA Today's top 500 universities and say like, oh, what percentage of your universities are rated high? Or could have used, you know, a bunch of different measures. One that we specifically honed in on was the return on investment.
Mm.
I think that's going to, that shows both, you know, it shows a few things. I think some direct, some more indirect. One, it shows, you know, okay, well, what's the true bang for your buck that you're getting from these universities?
Sure.
Across these different states, and realizing that states don't have, it's not equal across the U.S., right? We talk about, you know, is a college degree worth it? And there's a lot of discussions about that. And I still think, you know, the broad consensus is college degrees, for the most part, on average, are very much worth it. And we find similar results when looking at these measures. But we show that, you know, this is not equal across states either. And it's definitely not equal across universities. So it gets at the affordability aspect, as well as the kind of the return or the bang for your buck on a lot of these universities, which shows that, you know, high quality universities are worth the pay. But if you're going to a, you know, relatively lower quality university and still paying a high actual price for those tuition, for that tuition, you might not be getting the returns that you hope for. One example I'll give is, you know, looking at the different states, is that Hawaii, for example, over 54%, about 54% of graduates from universities in Hawaii have a negative return on investment. If you compare that with the highest performing state is actually Michigan, where only 9.7% of attendees end up with a negative return on investment. So showing that it's, you know, stark across the two different states. And then, you know, the other states fall somewhere in between. But showing that, you know, for the most part, there's still a high return on investment. For example, like in Michigan, the return on investment, I believe, is well over $200,000. And that's, you know, the net present values, that's adjusting for, you know, how long you have to, how long it takes to actually see that return
sure.
matter. So I think measures like that, right, took a lot more time in terms of actually constructing the index, because you wanted to see like, okay, well, what are we really trying to get at, versus just like, oh, well, this is close enough, let's just kind of throw it in there and, you know, it'll kind of work.
Yeah.
So it really took a lot of time and effort, for myself and our team at Broad to look into these various measures and make sure, and kind of fact check them, make sure that they all y'all lined up with, you know, what we're actually trying to measure.
Yeah. And so what did you learn in putting together this index about the differences between states? Were there, you know, what states stood out? What characteristics did states have who have good social mobility?
Yeah, so what I would say for the states that tend to score high is that they, generally speaking, tend to score well across all four pillars, which makes sense because we take an average of the four pillars, so it kind of makes sense
logically. Did you weigh those pillars four. Just equally?
We decided, at least for now, to just stick with the equal weighting across them without trying to get into the debate of like, oh, you know, without until we do some more sophisticated work, perhaps in the future of like, oh, well, you know, studies show that this is, you know, 40%, this is 20%. We wanted to keep it even across the four pillars just as a starting point. Say like, hey, look, we're not trying to like skew the results in any way. We're just, you know, taking the average of the four pillars. So all high performing states tend to score pretty well, even if they're not the best in every particular pillar. But they all score relatively well. So, for example, Utah scores highly. I believe they're in the top 15 or 20 for each of the – they're definitely in the top 20 for each of the four pillars. For example, they score third best in entrepreneurship and economic growth. They score – I believe where they score lowest is on institutions and rule of law. And then still they're 19th. In education and skills development, they're in the top 15. Social capital, they're in the top 3. So they stand out because they basically score well across all these different measures. As opposed to a state like, unfortunately, Louisiana, where I am from and where I live, where they score close to the bottom 10 pretty much across the board. So Louisiana scores 30th in the environment for entrepreneurship and economic growth, but they score in the bottom 5 and sometimes last in all those other aspects as well. So it really goes to show just the vast differences across these states. I think whenever creating this index and kind of finding the final results, what I found most interesting is that there's no political party or no political side tends to do particularly better than one side or the other, which I found at least somewhat interesting. In the fact that there's top 10 states that are red states and are blue states. So in the top 10 red states, we have Utah and Wyoming, Idaho, Nebraska. While blue states in the top 10 are Vermont and Colorado. And the bottom 10, there's red states and blue states as well. So in the bottom 10, you see states like Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, West Virginia, Arkansas. But you also see bottom 10 states that are blue states as well. Now, those are states like California, New York. And, you know, it kind of fits with, you know, in some ways what exactly you would expect in that regard.
And what do you, how did Michigan do on the index?
Michigan scored 29th. So they're pretty much about average. And again, that, you know, it differs across the different variables. So like I mentioned earlier, they do well on specifically universities, but actually overall on education and skills development, they score, they're actually score the same that they score overall, which is 29th.
Okay.
And that's in part because the education freedom and some of the education quality measures on in the lower levels, lower than university levels, tend to fall behind as well as childcare regulations. Michigan itself, you know, is basically in the mid-20s to 30th in all the different pillars. So they basically across the board stand out as pretty middle of the road.
So can you walk us through maybe a little, maybe this is, it's kind of a thought experiment, but so if I'm in a state that has lots of social mobility, I'm in Utah, what will I experience as a resident of that state? And then how will it be different if I'm in Louisiana? Like what are the barriers that you'd face in Louisiana that you might not in Utah? Can you just walk through kind of more like at the ground level of what that might mean for people?
Yeah, definitely. So in the extreme examples of Utah and Louisiana, I think if you're a child born in Utah, for example, you're much more likely to come from stable family that has high parental engagement. And just at the get-go, that has a huge explanatory power in terms of later outcomes. That because, again, like at the home, you know, at school is where you might learn some of the more like kind of direct skill education skills, but the soft skills and the cognitive behavior and the cognitive skills and the social skills, you learn some at school, but you definitely learn a lot of that at home as well. So missing that factor kind of is going to set a child back pretty much it from the get-go, unfortunately. And, you know, as they progress, you know, if they grow up in a higher quality schooling system with more school choice, well, that's going to allow for different opportunities for a child to, you know, go to a school that fits their skill sets a little bit better. That gives you at least the parents more opportunities and more choices in terms of what they view as best for their child, right? If your child is particularly skilled in the arts or the sciences, you'll have more opportunities in those kind of high school choice states. And that's actually one area where I think Utah, for example, could do better. And Louisiana is actually seeing some good positive momentum. And then when it comes down to, okay, you make a choice between going to college or going to, you know, community college or going straight from work. What matters there are the kind of initial barriers of the state from the beginning. So whether that's, you know, occupational licensing, which Louisiana is notoriously bad at, particularly for low income jobs, they have the highest number of occupational licensing regulations in terms of for jobs that are traditionally more lower income. So what that means is, it makes it even harder for someone who's low income already in a state with a lot of childhood poverty to actually overcome that barrier, because there's this permission slip that's hard to pass in a state like Louisiana. While other states like Utah, typically, generally speaking, their regulations are lower, so they have more opportunities. They have fewer occupational licensing, particularly for low income jobs, that allows for more opportunities. And as well as the tax system is more burdensome in a state like Louisiana than in many other states. Louisiana, I believe, now has the highest sales tax rate across the country, I believe, with the initial bill. And there's been some momentum to, you know, lower the individual income rates, which, you know, is essentially a tax on work and a tax on effort. So if you tax something, you expect to get, you definitely get a lower return for your effort that you put in and the value they provide in the marketplace. It also disincentivizes work to some degree as well. So across the entire someone's life, and then also with Louisiana, you have these potential issues of corruption or state predatory action that, you know, make it more likely that, you know, decisions are going to be made based off of political favoritism as opposed to your value in the marketplace. So that protects incumbents at the expense of, you know, someone who some hotshot who wants to start this new opportunity or this new job. So across the board, unfortunately, I think Louisiana, for example, has a lot of room to grow, while in a situation like Utah, where you come from typically stable families and enter a workforce that is much more dynamic and has a lot more opportunities with a lot fewer barriers and a lower disincentive to work and a higher reward for that effort and work, you're set up in a much better position and your probability of being more successful is going to be much higher in those states.
Yeah, so it seems to me that there's quite a few of these barriers that are, and these are probably the artificial ones that you're identifying, that are,
yep,
you know, clearly connected to a policy, to a government policy. So occupational licensing, of course, you know, these are just laws that force people to go through training and education and pay fees and take tests and stuff just to get a permission slip to work legally. So all of those make sense of, well, okay, we can improve social mobility by fixing those policies, right? But what is your take on some of the natural barriers that are connected closely to any one particular policy area? For instance, you know, the strength of a family, for instance, or community involvement and activity. Those aren't so easily reformed through government policy. So how do you think about those? What should we do about them? How can those natural barriers be addressed?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in terms of these artificial barriers, there's definitely a less direct but still some effect from policies. So I think in one regard, for example, and this is unfortunately mostly due to federal regulations. So there's very little states specifically can do about this, but it's more of a nature of the system that we've set up at the federal government level. in terms of access to these different welfare policies and marriage penalties. So I'll start with marriage penalties. It's essentially, it's based on, for the most part, federal tax code that for parents or individuals who have children at the kind of at the border of poverty, kind of in between the border of poverty and non-poverty, they kind of at those margins, they're actually disincentivized to stay married because they receive fewer subsidies if they are married versus being separated. Mm. And that's going, you know, and this is not a statement on any, you know, anyone particularly at the individual level, right? It is especially if you're already in that dire circumstance, there's a true financial, you know, burden that you place by being married and actually gain more opportunities. We've set up this welfare system to where we, you know, if you're at the kind of margin, you actually pay a heavy fine essentially mm-hmm. to get to work and to achieve stable income because the incentives that you receive or the welfare that you receive is actually going to be greater than the amount of money extra that you make. And especially, you know, very few people move from like a $10 an hour job to a $40 an hour job, right? It's usually more incremental steps. So people stop, you know, on the incremental levels, they stop taking those higher wages because they are essentially pushed against doing it. They're incentivized not to do it, and they're incentivized to not be married. And if we know, you know, the obvious positive benefits of children growing up in married households, it's a big shame that we've set up the federal government system in such a way, and the tax code in such a way, that we have this disincentive to be engaged as a family unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in terms of community involvement, I think that's one of the places, because this is something I found interesting when looking at the report, is many of the states that score the worst on social capital, so that kind of community involvement and charity, the states that score the lowest on that tend to be states that have the most out-migration. So if you look at some of the states that have a lot of the lowest social capital scores, it's states like Louisiana or Mississippi, as well as New York and California and Illinois. These are all states that people have moved out of over time over the past 10, 20 years.
Right.
I think what is kind of necessarily happening here is that you're breaking up communities because people can't achieve opportunities that they want to in those states. Mm-hmm. So they're forced to leave. And, you know, with that leaving, they're essentially leaving behind that community that they made there, realizing that once you move to these states, you know, once you move to a new place and you leave the area you are, well, that your community is no longer in the area that you were. And this isn't to say that people should just stay where they're from so they have this community. It's more of a signal that something is that there's these other unintended consequences of out-migration. That you're essentially people are having to leave just to, you know, survive or pay bills or thrive in some circumstances. But what you're leaving behind are some of those kind of close-knit connections. And it's obviously harder to make those close-knit connections in a new place than it is in the place you were.
Yeah.
So I found that pretty interesting that there's not a direct policy tie in terms of, you know, you don't want the government saying like, oh, you should, you know, everyone needs to be in a volunteer group or everyone needs to be a part of some group. Yeah, that's a hard rule to enforce in the first place, nor is I think it would actually achieve what you would want it to achieve. It just becomes as a nature of some of the, it's a byproduct of a lot of these other poor policy decisions that have pushed mm-hmm. people out in the first place.
Yeah. So how do you think social mobility has changed over time in the U.S.? Are we more socially mobile today than we have been in the past? Is it improving or increasing generally? And then I also want to ask, too, this concept of social mobility is, you know, I wouldn't say it's brand new, but it's relatively new. Do you think it's gaining traction as a way for policymakers to think about how to address issues like poverty and lack of opportunity?
Yeah, I think you're right in saying that the concept of social mobility is pretty relatively new. But I think at its kind of foundation, it really is what the American dream is all about. Mm. So the idea of the American dream is that you can work hard, achieve skill sets, provide value in the marketplace, and you will be rewarded regardless of the situation you grew up in. So the concept, right, what we defined it as, or what we've called it recently, social mobility, is really, you know, it's just the American dream. When people are talking about the American dream, they're talking about social mobility. And that is, you know, so I think when we talk about social mobility, we should first realize that, you know, we're really talking about the American dream, which is, you know, something that has been talked about for, you know, 250 years at
least
point, coming up this year, at least 250 years at this point. In terms of the state of social mobility, there's, especially going back to Raj Chetty, I think there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, is the U.S. still the land of opportunity? And I still think to the large degree, and he has some figures and some numbers that, you know, they have their issues, but overall kind of show the point that opportunity is harder to achieve in the U.S. or social mobility or mobility in general is harder to achieve in the U.S. today than it is back then, than it is, you know, 50, 40 years ago. Yeah. And while I do think that there is some credence to this argument, I still think, you know, by showing the different effects across states like we have in this report, you know, I do want to emphasize as well that, you know, this is still a country that opportunity is still possible, right? You see, if you just look at, you know, who were the top, you know, the richest families in the U.S. today versus 40, 50 years ago, it's not the same families. Right. There's still, and obviously that's an extreme example of like the ultra billionaires and, you know, the people that, you know, the vast majority of us will never even be close to achieving. But it, if that's true there, I think that it's definitely true across the entire country. This country still, you know, there's a reason that so many people want to move to the United States from all these other countries in the world, is that there's still a lot of positive things about the United States. And there's obviously things, you know, that I have problems with going on in the U.S. today or 10 years ago, 20 years ago, what have you. But broadly speaking, there's still a place in the United States. There's still a place that there's plenty of opportunities that there's still. And I think that the stigma behind like, oh, you know, that we're kind of seeing today that, oh, you know, the United States is, you know, we're late stage capitalism or we're, you know, in the end of the decline of, stagnation, we're at the end of the decline. I think that is mostly misguided. And if anything, if people truly believe that, and that does become more of the norm or more of the belief, it's actually going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I think at the core, we have to, you know, kind of stop that idea at its core, because then if everyone thinks that, you know, oh, it's all going to hell in a handbasket, well, then people aren't going to want to achieve the different opportunities and possibilities. And I'll finish up this by saying, by noting that, you know, at the Archbridge Institute, we do this American Dream snapshot every single year. And I believe we've done this report now for 6 years or so. And every single year, we still find that the vast majority of Americans, usually around 70%, still believe that they've either achieved the American Dream or they're on their way to achieving the American Dream. So it's still showing that, you know, if you ask, you know, across the country, you ask people their own situations, they're much more like they see it as a much more positive note than what a lot of the discussions that people have around the state of the United States have. What's interesting about that is that if you look at, you know, how people believe see their own situation and compare that to how people see the situation in the U.S. overall, there's a huge disconnect. That, you know, again, roughly 70% say that, you know, this is still a place that, you know, I'm achieving the American dream or I'm on my way to achieving the American dream. But if you ask the same people about, you know, the state of the country as a whole, they say about 50% of people can achieve the American dream, or 50% say that, you know, the American dream is still possible at large. Well, obviously, there's some disconnect between those two things. And I think that has to do a lot with the discourse around it. So I think if you stop the discord, you know, stop the negative discord, discourse around the American dream and still realize that this still is a country where opportunity is possible, you can get rid of a lot of those. You know, it ends up being true at the individual level. So just realizing that it's true at the individual level. So therefore, it must be true at the country level as well.
Yeah. Well, that was a great economist, traditional classic. On the one hand, this, and on the other hand, this. And you left us kind of ambivalent in the middle. So perfect. Perfect. That's all the time we have for the podcast. Justin, thanks so much for being on. Look forward to looking at that report on social mobility more from the Archbridge Institute.
And thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.